Coming up on Star Talk, we're reopening old wounds regarding the status of Pluto. I've got with me in my office Alan Stern, Mr. Pluto himself, and we spend the whole time talking about that little bugger in the outer solar system.
Welcome to Star Talk, your place in the universe where science and pop culture collide. Star Talk begins right now.
This is Star Talk. Neil deGrasse Tyson here, your personal astrophysicist. Today we're going to do cosmic queries. And we got Chuck for this, right?
Oh, definitely.
But this is a very special cosmic query.
It is.
Oh, this hits deep.
Yes, it does.
This
is the Montague and Capulets. This is the West Side Story of dwarf planets.
We got with me my friend and colleague, Alan Stern. Alan, welcome back.
Neil, thank
to,
you.
Give me some love here.
Oh,
man. Alan, welcome back to the crib here. We're here at my office at the American Museum of Natural History. And you're one of the world's, I'm going to say the world's expert on Pluto. Can I say that?
Wow. You just did. Yes.
The man, but let's hold Pluto just for a minute. I just want to catch up. I haven't seen him in years.
I got to say this Pluto thing, though. Sometimes I feel like I'm typecast like an actor on Gilligan's Island.
Oh.
It's the only thing people talk about is Pluto.
No, actually, I don't want to. We'll get to Pluto because this is a cosmic queries, and so people they can't shake Pluto.
Yeah.
You know that. People can't shake Pluto.
Well, it's everybody's favorite planet.
It's everybody's favorite. So, but let's catch up. What have you been doing? So you're still a vice president at the Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, part of the space division. Very busy research institute. A lot of different scientific.
A lot of science. A lot of engineering. Mm-hmm. The institute was formed back in the 1940s for the public good.
Oh my gosh!
And does a lot of federal research, state and local stuff, but also research consortiums for industry. Everything from oil and gas.
To Texas.
Automobiles. Electric vehicles, automated vehicles, mm-hmm. Just thousands of engineers and scientists.
Cool. So you've been there for, since you left NASA?
That's right.
Okay. So you may remember I was at the launch of New Horizons mission back in 2006. And if I remember correctly, that mission to Pluto was the most powerful rocket with the lightest payload ever. Just in combination, so that it could accelerate and get the hell out there before you died.
Mission accomplished.
That's the number one rule in any science project.
Yeah. When I was a little kid, I was washing cars and babysitting and doing everything I could think of to buy bigger and bigger model rockets. You have no idea.
The kind you would launch in your backyard.
Yeah, Estes model rockets.
Estes,
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The biggest one was the Saturn V, with like four D engines or something.
Right, the D engines.
The D engines was the biggest.
I only got the one where you stomped on a balloon and it shot it off with water.
Yeah.
I couldn't get any further.
That's a starter kit.
That's a starter kit.
Yes, exactly.
That's lame. But
then we got the New Horizons, 81 foot tall rocket, 70 mm-hmm. foot payload bay. Most powerful variant. I got to order every upgrade. You know, I'll take the lightweight nose cone. I would like all five solid rocket motors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything to make it go as fast as possible.
Right.
And then we built this little spacecraft the size of a desk. Very compact. So this thing was built to launch school bus size spy satellites and big communication satellites and things like that. And we more or less took an Atlas V, amped it up with every upgrade you could think of, and then launched it basically empty. Mm-hmm. And of course, you got the highest possible burnout speed. So, Apollo astronauts, 3 days to the moon.
We're now talking about New Horizons, no longer about your kid model rockets, right?
He transitioned very quickly that way.
We're in the big boy rockets.
Yeah, that was a blurry transition. I was like, man, you were a really advanced kid.
But think about this. Apollo would launch 25,000 miles an hour, 3 days to the moon.
Nice.
You know, Tom Hanks. Right?
Exactly.
Right? New Horizons, 9 hours.
Right. And didn't you get to the asteroid belt in 3 days or something?
Well, not that quick. But we got to the asteroid belt in record time. Faster than any spacecraft.
Yeah.
Just 3 months.
Right.
And Jupiter in a year.
Okay. But this also meant by the time you got to Pluto, you were booking.
Yeah.
Right? So
how do you slow down take a picture of Pluto?
I mean, in the old days, we got used to flybys.
Right.
And later on, you went into orbit. But this was like the resurrection of the flyby.
Right.
Right.
Where you got to get ready for all your data in just a few seconds.
And one shot.
One shot?
Once you're gone, you're not making a U-turn.
You can't come back. Right.
Get it so right.
So wait a minute. Can we see just one blurry picture with a sound effect that goes, meow.
You hope the pictures are not
pretty
blurry.
Much it.
So anyway, it was a fond memory being there. And so it took how long to get to Pluto?
It took 9.5 years.
Nine and a half years.
Because it's a long way.
And so you just in the Bahamas over those 9 years?
That's all I was doing. Yeah. Yeah.
So no, when you do that.
We were busy. I mean, you had a lot to do.
When you do that, when is the optimum time? When is Pluto closest to us so that you can intersect it?
Right. Well, the optimum time in order to get there fast is when it's in a certain orbital position, but it's not closest. It's near closest,
okay.
But what really matters is it's in the plane of the solar system.
Okay.
And we got there right at that exact time. In fact,
Pluto's way the f*** out of the plane of the solar system.
Oh.
that was implicit and unstated. So at the point where it crosses the plane of the solar system, you don't want to launch something from here and have to leave the plane of the solar system. That's where all your momentum is.
It takes a lot more fuel.
And that
slows you down if you have a spin fuel. Climbing out of the plane.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
Because you're already in the plane with Earth.
Right.
And you got, all of this adds to your favor.
Right.
Okay, continue. Sorry for that interruption.
Where were we? We took a little detour.
Yeah, it was 9 years.
9 years out. Right.
Yeah, so 9 years. But, you know, like the Voyagers, which went all the way out to Neptune, they had 500 people on that project. Scientists, engineers, flight controllers. By the time the whole way, exactly.
Yeah.
And by the time, and we did it with 50 people.
Wow.
And so the 50 of us were doing the work.
You're doing everything.
Yeah.
Doing everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we were pretty busy.
So then with our friend of Star Talk, David Grinspoon, Dr. Funky Spoon. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's, you banded together with him to write Chasing New Horizons.
Yeah.
And with this long subtitle.
Yeah.
What was that subtitle?
Inside the epic mission to explore the ninth planet.
Did he say ninth planet?
Ninth planet.
We'll get back to that.
Oh, boy. Here we go.
Blood drawn.
Happening already. Shot across the bow.
Blood drawn.
Oh, here it is.
Blood drawn. No, so that's that book was needed because Pluto was a big mystery for so many people for so long.
Well, yeah. And this mission was, so much in the public eye really need to be documented.
Yeah,
of course, David's an amazing writer.
Yeah, we all love David. We all love David. So also, since then, you've been in space, I hear?
Yeah.
You went above the Kármán line?
Wow.
We did that on Virgin Galactic.
On Virgin Galactic.
Did Neil's Pluto news upset you that much? You're like, I'll show you. I'll go investigate it myself.
Let me get into space.
I'll prove it myself. Like, I'm going to space, damn it.
How long? Was it like 4 minutes of weightlessness? About how long is
that? 4 minutes between engine cutoff and reentry.
Yeah.
But a hell of a ride and a tremendous experience to see the planet.
So what science were you doing on it?
Yeah, I was.
So you weren't just joyriding?
Right. Okay. As much as I wanted to look out the window, I was sent, I'm going to be doing a NASA mission, which is going to be determining how well the Virgin Galactic spacecraft can be used to do astronomy on these missions, like unmanned sounding rockets.
Mm.
And on this first mission, I did some physiological experiments using myself as the guinea pig, and also some practice for the astronomy mission, kind of get the timing of everything down.
Okay. So you weren't purely a tourist.
Right. In fact,
I mean, that's noble, but still sucks. I'd rather just look out the window the whole time.
Right, yeah. Just be there for the ride. You know what I mean?
And you would love it. You should do it.
Yeah, I don't know.
Mm.
Beautiful view.
Yeah, what? Listen,
why not? Why wouldn't you?
Any industry that considers an exploding rocket on the launch pad a success, I'm not.
No, they don't call it success. They call it an experiment rich in data.
That's even worse.
That's what the rocket people call it. No. So what else you been up to?
Been doing a lot of research, as a scientist.
Right, because your expertise is obviously not just Pluto. Your solar system objects of all kinds.
Nice.
Asteroids, comets,
Yeah, working on things all across the solar system, mm-hmm. even the moon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on Europa Clipper that's going to be launching this year to study Europa and the ocean of Europa, the plumes and the right. potential nice. For biology.
The liquid under yeah. surface.
Yeah. yeah, yeah. I'm on the Lucy mission, which is an asteroid mission. Uh-huh. Just got launched in 2021.
Is Lucy an acronym?
No, Lucy's a pretty name. It was named after Australopithecus Lucy.
Oh, that Lucy.
Oh, yeah. Lucy.
Which was named after the Beatles. Lucy in the yeah. Sky with Diamonds.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's all about
everything
just
goes back
like
to the Beatles.
The Australopithecus. Yeah. It's about the origin of our solar system. Just like the origin of hominids.
I see what you did there.
That makes sense.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Oh, the Lucy mission. Very
yeah.
cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And what data are you gathering to tell you about the origin of this little solar system?
Well, all these missions contribute to that.
Oh.
Right? It's a big, kind of like CSI, right? With hints and clues everywhere. And you have to build a whole
CSI,
story.
CSI, the solar system.
Yeah, you got it. All of a sudden, Alan takes off his glasses and you go, yeah!
There we go. So,
mysteries unsolved. Yeah.
You know, the Lucy mission is a good example. The asteroids it's going after co-orbit with Jupiter. Neil won't like this, but they orbit in Jupiter's orbit, and there are tens of thousands of them that Jupiter has not cleared. Nonetheless, planet Jupiter
has these Trojan pockets of asteroids.
Trojans and leading and trailing.
Yeah.
Lucy's the first mission to go explore them. Mm-hmm. It's thought that these asteroids.
Just to be clear, so these are places in the Jupiter Sun system.
Okay.
Where forces of gravity and centrifugal forces balance. So like Lagrangian points.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, we did a whole thing on Lagrangian points.
Yes, we did.
That's a whole explainer. So Jupiter has a forward and trailing Lagrangian points and stuff. Finds
just
itself
gets
there.
Trapped in it?
Yeah, it's like it doesn't know where to go because there's nothing pushing it anywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
And there they go around the solar system.
It's like the Wizard of Oz, Poppy Fields.
What?
You know, you just wander in and you just stay.
Is that what?
Yeah.
It's a little like that.
Yeah.
And the objects that are there are thought to be sourced from the same region as a lot of the Kuiper Belt objects.
Okay.
So we're going there so we can compare them to the Kuiper Belt objects that New Horizons has explored.
Nice, nice.
And we see if it's really right, if that part of the story is
correct. Remind me, the leading ones were Trojans. Did they have a different name for the
trailing
ones?
So why do you call them Trojans? I mean, because I'm thinking Trojan horse when I hear Trojan.
Right. Yeah.
Or is it?
Right. So it's got to be some origin for why they call it Trojan.
And I'm not a historian.
But didn't they call the other ones a different name?
No, there's just a leading and a trailing cloud.
Okay. Right, but
they're called the Lagrange points 4 and 5.
4 and 5, L4, okay. L5. But I think only one of these packs are called Trojans, and I think the other pack—
No, they're both called Trojans.
You think
they
so?
Are, I promise.
Okay.
Yeah. I think they have individual names, but they're more obscure.
Well, they hide something. People. That's what we know.
They what?
They're Trojans. They're hiding something. We should not trust them is what I'm saying.
So I'm glad we're finally learning more about these objects because they're just sitting out there waiting to be.
Yeah, and they've been begging for exploration and never.
Begging.
Never.
Totally
and now
begging.
The Lucy mission is going to go see almost a dozen of them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Some of them have satellites and we'll visit some of those.
Okay.
And that that mission got launched in 2021. We just did a first practice asteroid flyby in the main belt. We're going to do another practice asteroid flyby in 2025.
How many people get to say that? It's practice with a whole asteroid.
That's amazing, I got to tell you.
Because we got to get it right on those flybys.
Uh-huh.
And then, starting in the late 20s, we'll do a whole series we'll do a whole series of flybys of Trojans. And then we'll dive back in our orbit down close to the sun and come back out and go to the other Trojan cloud where we'll complete that exploration. If there's an extended mission, we'll do even more.
Wow.
And this will all end in the 2030s. So it's a long-term program of exploration.
So just to be clear, once you've established this orbit around the sun going out to Jupiter,
right,
it's minimal fuel, right? Because the you've already earned this orbit.
That's right.
And so now you're just sort of redirecting it a little bit.
Right. So the rocket does the initial boost, and then we do Earth gravity flybys. We've already done one.
Yeah.
We have two more to do to make the whole mission come.
Yeah.
And the principal investigator, Hal Levison, is a part of the team that dreamed up the whole geometry and orbital mechanics of how you get so many flybys into just one mission.
Right. This is the genius of what they got to do. Like with the Cassini mission to Saturn.
Right.
it's orbiting Saturn, but it's visiting moons every time. Yeah. And all these loop orb. Oh, let's check out this other one. Do a little adjustment. I mean, it's brilliant that we can exploit the gravitational fields of other stuff. I mean, it's almost diabolical.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you, like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the US on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
Whether you're a family vacation traveler, business tripper, or long weekend adventurer, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. And that's good, because there are a lot of me's. Choice Hotels has over 7,400 locations and 22 brands, including Comfort Hotels, Radisson Hotels, and Cambria Hotels. Get the best value for your money when you book with Choice Hotels. Cambria Hotels feature locally inspired hotel bars with specialty cocktails and downtown locations in the center of it all. Hey, that's me. Radisson Hotels have flexible workspaces to get the most of your business travel and on-site restaurants. That's me, too. And at Comfort Hotels, you'll enjoy free hot breakfast with fresh waffles, great pools for the entire family, and spacious rooms. Hey, that's me, too. I guess I'm just going to have to stay at all of them. Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Book direct at choicehotels.com, where travel comes true.
I'm Alikhan Hemraj, and I support Star Talk on Patreon. This is Star Talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
So, Alan.
Neil.
Alan.
Neil. It's a pattern.
Don't get me started. Okay, get me started.
Neil.
We alerted our fan base that you were going to be on. And most of them knew your expertise, but others were fresh in the room for that. And we collected questions.
Yes, we from did. Them.
And these are Patreon members.
Yes, they are.
Excellent.
Yes.
These are excellent.
These are the people who keep us afloat.
Let's see what questions.
What do you have?
Mm-hmm. All right, here we go.
I haven't seen them. I don't know anything about them.
Let's go with Sean Ravenfire. Now I wonder if that's a real name or
Ravenfire.
Not. Ravenfire. It sounds like, you know, a video game character. I am Sean Ravenfire. I am here to collect the crystals.
The crystals.
All right.
Not even the money, right?
No,
it's
got
to be something. Yeah.
But your money is meaningless. Give me the crystals. Okay. Sean says, hey, I'm still a little fuzzy on the difference between minor planet, dwarf planet, and planetoid.
Ooh.
Can you please explore the differences?
You know, I'm fuzzy too, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody's fuzzy because the terms are not, you know, some of them, like planetoid, no one uses. You hear it very occasionally. No scientist I know uses the term planetoid.
Wait.
I don't even hear.
What do they call Thea? Wasn't that a
Thea,
planetoid?
So
Thea was that an, made the moon.
The term is planetary embryo. That's the term that's really used.
This sounds like a PC thing. You got to add syllables and add another word.
But that is the term that's used.
Planetary embryo that collided with
Earth right?
to make
the Earth moon.
I did not know that.
That'd be a planetary spermatozoa?
Okay.
Yeah.
You're talking about never.
But, you know, the embryos are basically the building planets. And there were a lot more of them originally than there are now because many of them combined through collisions to make bigger and bigger objects. Thea ended up spalling material into orbit around the Earth and it collided. It created the moon. But most of Thea ended up in the Earth.
Right.
And this was a big thing. It was the size of Mars.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Big hit. Right?
So I was just trying to get my vocabulary straight here. So you would call that a planetary embryo, not a Planetoid.
Because no one uses that. Really.
Okay.
So now
it's really an archaic.
Okay.
Term.
Is that the same as protoplanet? The planetary embryo
and protoplanet. Those are interchangeable.
Okay. Oh, we're good. So protoplanet. Good. Protoplanet. All right. So now, for the longest while, my whole life growing up, we're about the same age. I knew of this thing called the Minor Planet Circular.
Right.
Which tracked asteroids, basically. Right. So I always thought of asteroids collectively as minor planets.
Yeah.
Is that term still a thing now that we've added vocabulary to the system?
Sometimes it's used. And it's mostly used for the small, kind of potato-shaped, lumpy things in the solar system, not the bigger things.
Okay.
The term dwarf planet, I'm actually very proud of this. I coined the term in 1991 in a research article in the journal Icarus. And it was meant to be...
Icarus features planet-based, solar-system-based science.
This is the
solar system... Distinct from the first journal.
Research journal of solar system science.
Okay.
And Carl Sagan was one of the original editors of it back in the 60s, 70s when planetary science was being born as a field. Mm-hmm. And in 1991, I published an article that was about mathematical prediction, that there would be a large number of Pluto-like objects discovered.
Mm-hmm.
And I termed them dwarf planets in analogy to dwarf stars and dwarf galaxies and so forth.
Okay.
And they're meant to be...
Because that word is already in use.
It's already in use.
We already
have
it.
Makes sense.
So
mm-hmm.
smaller, much smaller planets, the ones that are the size of continents. And that term's been used very widely.
Okay.
And we see dwarf planets all across the Kuiper Belt, which is part of the revolution of the Kuiper Belt that we didn't know about till the 90s, is that dwarf planets are more populous than the four terrestrial planets and the four giant planets combined.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one dwarf planet orbiting in the asteroid belt called Ceres.
Ceres.
The largest of
which
the asteroids,
asteroid.
Which is a mini planet itself.
Okay. So
right?
Okay.
Right? Asteroid's kind of a zip code. So, you know, it's like a Kuiper Belt object is kind of meaningless. It's just an object in the Kuiper Belt. It's like a zip code. Technically, New Horizons, the spacecraft, is a Kuiper Belt object. For the time being, it's an object in the Kuiper Belt.
Okay.
Right? So that's just a zip code. Right?
All right.
But
so now how do you get up to the term?
Specific.
Now, I'm not trying to push back here because I'm out of my league between you two. But I want to know, how do you go from being floating rock to planet? Because there's got to be a difference between...
It's a big difference.
Yeah.
It's
you know,
a big difference.
One of them is... How do you make the jump from, you know...
Well, let's start. Let's back up. How do you go from potato to dwarf planet?
Yeah.
So, the thing about potato-sized objects... So, these are things that are the size of counties or mountains. And they're, you know, most of the asteroids that you can look up in a book or that we've flown spacecraft by, they're lumpy. And they have irregular shapes. And that's because that's the shape that, as they were assembled, they just came to rest in when the assembly was finished.
Mm-hmm.
And that shape is controlled by the material strength of the object.
Okay.
The thing is, as objects get bigger and bigger, more and more massive, eventually they get massive enough that their self-gravity causes them to form into a sphere. And then we call them planets.
Okay.
Once they're big enough to be a sphere, like Pluto, mm-hmm. they're planets. The smallest of them are called the dwarf planets. And then there are larger planets that are Earth or Jupiter size. And
they're
eventually...
All spheres. And those are all spheres.
All spheres.
Those are, they're, yeah. There's a continuum. They're all spherical objects.
So sphere is definitely a determining characteristic.
It's the hallmark.
It's one of them.
It's the hallmark.
One of them.
If you're on Star Trek and they show up somewhere and turn on the viewfinder...
Everything
you
is
see,
round.
You see a round, right. rocky something or thing with an atmosphere that's round. You go, oh, they're a planet this week.
All right, let me ask you this, both.
But all did right, we get through dwarf planet, a planetoid, planet? What?
There's no
minor planet.
Yeah.
See, so
minor
you said
planet.
There's no
okay.
minor.
I just want to get
planets,
more questions.
Minor planets are these little rocky guys. They used mm-hmm. to be called, it's an 1800s, 1900s term, minor planet.
Okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a legacy term.
All right. So before we move on to the next question, one last question
fact,
for
asteroid
both.
Asteroid itself is very legacy.
Right.
Because who was it? Not Herschel, was it?
Somebody around 1800.
Some dude.
Yeah, he's got his telescope and he sees this dot of light. Like stars are just dots of light. They're so far away, they're just dots of light
right.
in your telescope. They see a dot of light, except it's moving.
Right.
And it's like, so it looks like a star, but it's not a star. So asteroid. Star-like.
Star-like.
Right. Yeah. So that's like the biggest misnomer there ever was.
Right.
Right. Yes, visually, but if you would care what the thing is, and we still call them asteroids, star-like from the Greek.
Excellent.
It's just legacy.
That's legacy. All right, so one last thing, and then we're going to move on because I'm taking up way too much of the Patreon's time. Does composition have anything to do with it? So let's just say that it's round, but it's an aggregate of just larger objects, but they're not condensed. They're not really solid. They're just kind of a congregation.
We haven't seen anything like what you're describing.
Oh,
and
okay.
If you look across the planets of the solar system, whether they're made of ice or rock or they're gas giants or whatever, they're all contiguous bodies, not agglomerations like you're describing.
Right.
Right? They're one big spherical thing because the gravity crushes everything into that spherical shape.
Okay.
Right? And they might have a core and a mantle and a big atmosphere above it, for example. Or they might have a core and a mantle and an ocean layer like Europa.
Right.
And then an outer layer of ice. Right. For example, right? But they're all the same. They're essentially spherical objects, and their shape is driven by the force of their own mass that creates self-gravity.
Okay.
You know, another way to say this is, if you had three objects that were each themselves massive enough to be their own sphere,
right,
and you bring them together,
right,
they're making a sphere.
They're making
That's how it rolls.
We're making a sphere no matter what.
But the same thing applies when stars collide and they can merge into a still bigger star, into a larger sphere.
Right.
Right? And it's the same physics.
Okay. All the way through. No matter where you are in the universe.
That's the good thing about physics.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
All right, give me some more.
All right.
And make this quicker this time.
All right, here we go. This is Andrew Coffey, who says, "Good day, Dr. Tyson, Lord Nice, Sir Alan. I know very little about Pluto, so I'm super excited to hear you talk. I'm hoping you can enlighten me. I'm wondering if celestial bodies like Pluto are only able to form and exist at the extreme distance from the sun, or could they be orbiting closer, perhaps near a smaller or cooler star? And if so, do we hope finding an exoplanet that is similar, simply too small or too far away from the star to be seen from the distances involved in our observations? Thank you." That's two parts. One, you know, is the distance from the sun?
The main part is, you know, could you have them close to the sun?
Right.
In fact, everything we know about the origin of the solar system indicates that Pluto formed at something like half its present distance from the sun. That the solar system is more compact originally. Mm-hmm. And Pluto and most of the other dwarf planets of the Kuiper Belt were transported outward with also the small bodies of the Kuiper Belt. But Ceres is another example. Now, Ceres is in the asteroid belt. It's a dwarf planet. Some people think it formed there. Mm-hmm. Others can argue that it may have come from the Kuiper Belt itself. So we don't know, but we know that dwarf planets can exist much closer to the sun.
So just for clarification's sake, because there are people who may not know, the proximity of when you're talking about asteroid belt, Kuiper Belt, mm-hmm. the sun, Pluto, and so how's it go? Where's it go?
So the sun's in the middle of the solar system, right? It's the big kahuna, right? That controls all the other orbits, right? And then we have the four rocky planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars.
Right.
And then there's an asteroid belt just beyond the orbit of Mars.
Okay.
It stretches for something like 100 million miles outward.
Jesus.
Okay, it's big.
I did not know that.
And then you got the gas giants.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Who knew that?
Go ahead. You have Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune.
Right.
By now, Neptune's orbit is 30 times as far away from the sun as the Earth's is.
Right.
Right? And probably 15-ish times as far away as the asteroid belt.
Right.
Okay?
Okay.
And then beyond Neptune's orbit is this second belt or disc-like region called the Kuiper Belt, discovered in the 1990s but predicted back in the 1940s and 50s. And that's where Pluto orbits and a bunch of other dwarf planets and a bunch of much smaller Kuiper Belt objects that are more like asteroids but much more icy than the asteroids.
Wow. Okay.
And if I understand correctly, the Kuiper Belt was a negative prediction.
What does that mean? I didn't learn that in school.
Yeah, I think it was a negative prediction. I think Gerard Kuiper published a paper saying that there should be a reservoir of objects. I don't know if we call them comets at the time. A reservoir of objects just beyond the red-blooded planets. And since we don't see any there, then he was making some inference about the early solar system. So he was using the absence of evidence as an evidence for something else. And then we find stuff there and we name it after him.
Yeah, I think it was actually a little different. My recollection of the literature from back then is that there were really two scientists. One was named Kenneth Edgeworth and the other was Gerard Kuiper. They were both making predictions that beyond the orbit of Neptune, that there was something like an asteroid belt that Pluto orbited in, and that it might contain other planets in it. But it was really beyond the technology of the mid-20th century.
The telescopes couldn't do it, and detectors,
And, you know, you had, like, Clyde Tombaugh squinting at photographic plates. They didn't have the data analysis
tools. Clyde Tombaugh, the discoverer of Pluto.
Yeah. Okay. Uh-huh. So they didn't have... They had big enough telescopes, but they didn't have sensitive enough cameras, and they didn't have computers to do the painstaking data analysis.
This is AJ Stavely, who says, hello, Dr. Tyson, Lord Nice, Dr. Allen, so much respect. I am AJ from Atlanta, Georgia. My question is, what unanswered questions has New Horizons answered or you have discovered about the Kuiper Belt that researchers like yourself didn't already know or you were surprised about? Also, is Pluto's dance with Charon why it appears to be so geologically active? Thank you so much.
Mm.
So a two-part question, both very cool.
Get through all of that.
Yeah, that's
a lot. We found a lot of discoveries.
Okay.
And you don't have enough time on this show. If I came back two or three more times.
All right, let's go top three then.
But okay,
top three then.
A good example is that Pluto itself.
Okay.
Right? We wondered for a long time if its surface would be flat or rugged. Basically, because we knew the surface is made of nitrogen ice, and nitrogen ice is structurally weak, it would make a surface that was almost entirely flat.
It's so weak that Pluto's gravity would just flatten it out.
Yeah, exactly.
Smooth
it
out.
You got it. But if the nitrogen is just a frosting on top of a water ice crust, you could have mountain ranges and canyons and craters and all the rugged topography that we actually saw. So we answered that question the first day with the first pictures that came back from New Horizons of Pluto.
Wow.
And then when we went further out into the Kuiper Belt and made the first flyby of a small Kuiper Belt object, we found out how they were born, how they were formed.
This was not an accidental encounter. You're targeting other Kuiper Belt objects with that trajectory.
And, and this was a goal of the mission. And a billion miles beyond Pluto, we flew by this Kuiper Belt object, Arrokoth. No one had ever been to a Kuiper Belt object. And from its shape... Yeah, it means sky in the Powhatan Indian language.
Okay, yeah, I knew that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Who doesn't know
Wait. You went to Pluto and then went another billion miles?
Yeah. And now we're almost twice as far as Pluto now and still exploring.
Okay.
But when we got to Arrokoth, from its geology and geophysics, we could determine that one of the major two theories of how planets get their start, how planetesimals, the seeds of planets form, was wrong, and the other theory was right. And we found that, essentially, that these little planetesimals, the seeds of planets, form very gently and through a very slow local accretion process in which they can...
Rather than
colliding at high speed.
Rather than collisions. Right. Interesting.
And there were decades in which computer models were warring, and in one fell swoop, New Horizons settled that with the data on Arrokoth.
Beautiful.
It showed you pick one out of a bag and look at it up close, and you could tell one theory's right, one theory's wrong.
Beautiful. So it means they just kind of gather.
Yeah, everybody comes together.
Statistics come together.
They start off in little pockets, and the little pockets end up with little material, boulders and hills and mountains that collide with one another very gently and just stick due to self-gravity. and build up a lumpy thing, not big enough to be a round thing.
Right.
Just a lumpy thing.
Right.
And tell us about the Pluto-Charon dance.
Oh, yeah. That was the other question. So the question was whether Pluto's intense geologic activity could be due to that. And it turns out not.
Due to?
To that dance.
To the gravity.
To the mutual gravity of Pluto and its big moon that are in a very special state called tidal equilibrium. Turns out that because of that equilibrium, all those forces that might heat Pluto or make that geology go are long gone. And
tidal equilibrium, you mean double tidal lock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
We know what that is.
But that can't be the cause of Pluto's geology. It's got to do something else.
Okay.
All right.
Interesting.
Very good.
All right.
And that
good
might have to do with the ocean
AJ.
That we think is inside of Pluto, just like Europa.
So the ocean is not rigid, so it can shake things up.
Right.
Well, it's also, as it freezes, releasing heat.
Oh, yeah.
Called latent heat. You know about that.
Yeah.
And that can power the geology.
Physics 101.
So wait a minute.
What?
Okay, I failed physics 101. Freezing gives off heat?
It does. It releases heat.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. All right. I'm going to tell you right now. I've been on this earth for a little while now. That's the first time I ever heard somebody say freezing gives off heat. So I'm just going to call bullshit.
No.
You can try.
No, I got one for you. I'm joking. I'm serious.
Go ahead.
Are you seated? Okay.
I'm seated.
Let's look at the other side. So you have water on the stove.
Right.
And you're heating it.
Right.
And as you heat it, the temperature rises. Correct?
Correct.
Okay. Then it hits what temperature?
Boiling point. 212. 212.
You keep heating it.
Yes, you do.
Where does the heat go?
Wait a minute.
It does not raise the temperature. Correct.
It turns into steam.
So the heat simply goes and changes it from liquid to gas.
So the molecular change is
itself.
Okay.
Okay, so now you go the other direction.
Holy crap.
Yeah, so now you go the other direction.
Yes.
Now you're gonna suck energy out of the water. The temperature drops.
Right.
And then there's a point where you're still sucking energy. The temperature doesn't drop.
Oh, man.
And all it does is change state.
Change the molecular state.
Right.
Damn. That's...
Where was he when you took that physics?
You might have done better. Yeah, I might have done a lot better.
You might have.
Had I had Neil.
Yeah. So we call it latent heat. There's terms for it in physics.
Latent heat.
It's really physics 101.
Hi, how y'all doing? I'm latent heat. Hey. Okay.
All right. You personified latent heat.
Yes, that's right.
I'll never get this out of my head.
I know, right? You can't do...
Oh, God.
Also, Charon, just in the traditions of the field, Pluto is Roman, god of the underworld.
Right.
And moons have traditionally been, not in all cases, but in many cases, traditionally named for Greek characters in the life of the Greek counterpart to that Roman god.
Okay.
And that way, there's an homage to both cultures.
You get both cultures.
Right. So Pluto's counterpart in Greek is what?
What's his face? The underworld.
Hades. Okay. It's also the place, but it's also the
guest. Yes.
Okay. And the ferry boat driver
to take you
across the River Styx is named Charon.
Charon.
Yes.
Oh,
That's where that came from.
Charon! Okay, here we go. Greetings, Dr. Tryson and Dr. Allen. I'm Jasmine from the wine country here in Northern California. Nice. I'm very curious. What's the big deal about Pluto? Does it even really matter if it's a planet or not? Why all the fuss over this icy rock at the edge of our solar system?
Oh, yeah.
Woo, look at that. Oh.
Can I venture a guess that it's been with us so deep in our culture, that it's hard to shake any adjustments to those?
Well, that's a guess. But as a scientist, the real reason is that Pluto is the archetype. It's the heralding body of this whole new type of planet, the dwarf planets that we've discovered in the outer solar system. They're active. They have moons. They have atmospheres in some cases. And far from being a rock, it's a big spherical thing.
Right.
Right? And that's why we call it a planet. We don't know what else to call it.
There you go. All right.
Planet modified by the word dwarf.
Right.
Like giant. Giant planet for Jupiter.
A gas. Yeah,
which I didn't have a problem. Yep. I mean, that's, in fact, where we agreed. Okay? And one of the correspondence I got back when I was pilloried by third graders. Because here, people know, I don't have to give the backstory here.
Dear Dr. Tyson, why are you so mean?
Well, what's really sad is not that he's mean. It's just that he's wrong.
Oh, snap. What happened?
Geek fight.
No, it's like...
So you failed your freshman physics. He did great at all that. He did all the way up through PhD, but he's failed his planet test.
No, so we have the word paper, right? Right. And we have construction paper, corrugated paper, toilet paper,
right.
A cardstock paper,
cardboard,
right? So this paper is a very broad category. And then we modify that with whatever is the next word, and then we know exactly what anybody's talking about.
Okay.
So I don't have any problem with that. Just let so it was. I've always felt there's been a shortage of vocabulary. So in other words, let me hear. I'm sure we agree here. Jupiter and Earth should not be called the same object in orbit around a star.
I disagree.
Nope. Yeah, they're round it, but one is huge in gases, and Earth is smaller than storms on Jupiter's weather system. So wouldn't it be cool if we just had a different vocabulary so that when I use the word, you know exactly what I was talking about. Okay. Right now, if I just say, I discovered a planet orbiting a star, so is it gaseous? Is it rocky? Is it large? Is it small? Is it? And I have to ask 20 questions just to understand what anybody's talking about.
That's the cool part of science. And as
No, that's a weakness of science.
As a planetary scientist, you know, planet is part of the term of what our field is all about, right? And so we know what planets are. They are the things... the central objects of our field, and they are the large things that orbit stars. And they range from the smallest large, they know they're large when they become round and gravity dominates. And from the dwarf planets all the way up to the giant planets, that's a continuum of objects we all call planets.
Yeah,
and planetary scientists agree on that. And in the planetary science research literature, there's no debate.
I don't have a problem. I'm a big fan of words. I have 6 dictionaries on my shelf over there from different eras, and I watch words come and go. I'm just saying, if you have to modify the word planet in order to know what someone is talking about, that's a clarion call for another word, a word yet to be invented that captures both of those simultaneously. And so it's a shortcoming of the lexicon. That's all I'm saying. That's one. Don't look at me. All blank. You see how he's looking?
Wow.
At me? You see how?
I'm telling you.
Did you see that face?
I'm telling you. By that, for example, we have different kinds of human beings, short ones, tall ones, skinny ones, big ones, right? We have North Americans and Europeans and South Americans, and that doesn't mean we need a new term for human beings. It just means adjectives help in the English language. And there are all kinds of ways to add descriptors to planets, to stars, to galaxies. We do that all through science, right? And we got to get over these small number fears, right? I mean, if we're going to have only 8 planets, Neil, I'm afraid the periodic table's got to stop at beryllium. You know, the periodic table has 100 and umpteen elements in it, right? We're not afraid of a large number of those.
No.
Just like we're not afraid of having 50 states, right? Or countless numbers of stars and asteroids and everything else.
We only have 49 states. Texas is not a state.
Well, by its
own country. Just ask anybody from there.
I've been to restaurants called Texas is a planet. So we get used to big numbers of planets now that we see them around stars and lots of them in our own solar system.
Okay. Doesn't Star Trek have a much more nuanced system and nomenclature for planets?
Yeah, because they classify planets.
Star Trek is fiction. We're talking about facts.
No, but let's imitate fiction.
Okay, because Alan, I was on your side until that statement right there. How dare you, sir?
Send him away, warp factor one. No, so I'm just saying there's a term, a succinct term that references... Is it an oxygen-nitrogen planet?
Right.
Is it gravity? There are ways of folding that into the term so that someone says,
I don't mind Star Trek having lots of kinds of planets.
I'm all in.
We got ocean worlds, right?
I'm all in.
And we got volcano worlds. We got biologically active worlds. Sterile worlds. It's all good.
All in.
There you go. Adjectives rock, don't they?
On it. Dude. Alan, great to have you back on.
Thanks so much, Neil.
Okay.
It's a pleasure.
All right. Great. Thanks. We're done here. Oh my gosh, but we're really not done, are
we? No, we have solved nothing. we must do it again because nothing has been resolved.
All right. So this has been Star Talk, the Pluto Cosmic Queries edition, if I may call it that. We're going to have to get Alan back because that we just barely scratched the surface here. Anyhow, thank you, Alan, longtime friend and colleague.
Thanks so much.
Chuck, always good to have you.
Always a pleasure.
All right. Neil deGrasse Tyson here, your personal astrophysicist. As always, keep looking up.